Today is Wednesday, December 17th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, HCOG explains new regional transportation plan. Southern Humboldt Fire Department assigned to form the Southern Humboldt Fire and Rescue Joint Powers Alliance December 20th. New greenhouse gas reduction rules approved by Humboldt Soups. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Last week, KMUD talked with Colin Fisk, the executive director of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities. During the interview, he talked about the Humboldt County Association of Governments, or HCOG's new Regional Transportation Plan, or RTP. The biggest problem Fisk has with the new four-year plan was the elimination of words climate crisis and a delay of needed climate action over the next 4 years. Unfortunately, KMUD was unable to get in contact with HCOG in time for the story's release. After the story was played, Brendan Bird, the executive director of HCOG, reached out to KMUD and explained the changes to the new RTP. Bird explained the RTP is a policy and planning document that does not actually set construction projects. It is a framework with policies, goals, and strategies that members can use when making decisions on transportation investments. A major concern that Fisk brought up is that HCOG changed language from the previous RTP 4 years ago, specifically replacing the phrase climate crisis with climate change, even changing a quote from a state agency. Bird said, a HCOG technical committee suggested changing the wording for messaging reasons.
One of the recommendations we received from one of our technical committees was to consider updating a specific term that is in our global climate change element. So it was previously worded as global climate crisis. And the recommendation we received to consider modification of was switching the word crisis to change. The intent of the comment was to say, hey, it's more consistent messaging with what folks are used to and conventionally used to, and we feel like we can maybe communicate the issue and the importance of the issue better if we do more conventional language and maybe try to stay away from some of the language that can be considered, you know, hot button language, so to speak. Not necessarily to in any way say that something is or isn't a crisis. That's not the intent of it at all. It's a change that's currently shown as a possible change in the document being circulated. And of course, it's out now for public consumption. And our board will consider what they want to see in a final document in February. I will note that before it went out to public circulation, it was an item discussed at length at the board meeting. And I do anticipate that there will be some modifications to that language in a final draft that is brought forward to our board. And the board is very sensitive and interested in this issue, too. I think realistically, it's just making sure that we can have an open dialogue about what the best way to message the issue is so that we can get as many folks coming along through the process as we can.
As for the accusation that the plan deleted the words climate crisis from an official quote from the California State Transportation Agency, Bird admitted that this did happen and it was a mistake.
That just came through to my attention and I was just talking to our staff about that. That was done in error because the thing is that is a piece of legislation. I think that was probably an unfortunate casualty of Control F, if you know what I mean, or Control F replace. So that absolutely is not intended to be that way. That needs to be brought back because that's exactly how it is worded.
Another problem Fisk and other groups that released the complaint was about that the draft plan proposed a delay in targets for non-car-dependent housing and electric vehicle charging stations. Bird says the intent is not about ignoring and changing the actual goals, but looking at the problem realistically, which means pushing back the deadline, especially in regards to EV charging.
Several years ago, the goal was to have about 10 times more charging stations than has ultimately been constructed. And it hasn't been for lack of effort. There have been a lot of governmental agencies moving forward and trying to do construction of such infrastructure. But realistically, the number of units that the goal is requiring is going to take some more time to do that. So the proposal is to add 5 years to those performance so that there's more time in order to achieve the goals. The alternative, of course, would be to leave it as it is, which could be fine too, which realistically would just say, hey, we have this goal and we haven't met it and we didn't meet it at the time that we set the goal.
He highlighted that the number of chargers is not planned to be reduced.
It's not changing the number of charging units. It's not changing the policy of trying to advance charging units. It's not changing the fact that the building code requires charging in new construction. It's just recognizing that if we're going to meet those numbers, it's going to take more time to get there, and it's going to take more investment to get there.
Byrd said the biggest barrier are state budget constraints and the reliance on grants to get things done.
And unfortunately, a lot of these types of things are constructed through discretionary state dollars and grant dollars. Those are all sources of income that current state budget woes aren't necessarily as readily available to us. So that's that. Again, it's not the total, it's not the intent, it's not the idea. It's just recognizing that if we're going to meet that number, that original goal date is already passed, and what we've seen is that it's just going to take more time if that's our real goal.
Another issue groups had with this new plan is its approach to vehicle miles traveled, or VMT. This looks at how many miles a personal vehicle has to drive every day. Byrd explained that local governments are having to traverse conflicting state requirements, especially the Regional Housing Need Allocation, or RHNA, which requires every jurisdiction to have housing opportunities no matter the area or size. Some of the areas would have higher VMT ratings, including cities like Ferndale, Trinidad, Blue Lake, Rio Dell, and places that are farther away from services and jobs. HCOG is still required to provide housing opportunities in these areas. The original RTP language said HCOG would not support any housing that increased county average VMT, which conflicts with those housing mandates.
So there was a slight modification to the RTP because the RTP policy said, hey, we do not support any housing that would increase county average VMT. And a housing unit in Rio Dell arguably would increase county average. So the language is just to provide for the knowledge that we have to do these other things insofar as meeting state mandates and state requirements that are brought upon us by other areas. It's not something we're necessarily excited about. We'd love to be able to, you know, do policies and enact things that were fully and of our own desires as a local agency and as a local area, but in meeting all of the various mandates, there's that level of compromise that we always have to be thoughtful of. So that modification is really just to kind of marry those two processes together.
Byrd insisted HCOG's goal is to prioritize projects that improve infrastructure and are financially sustainable.
The region's 100% stance, be it HCOG or any local agency, is to concentrate on infill, to concentrate on reducing sprawl, to concentrate on really thinking about how we utilize our existing investments and not continue to expand outward in a way that's not financially sustainable.
The original plan also set goals of making new housing walkable and bikeable. After the RTP was adopted in 2022, HCOG brought in an AmeriCorps Civic Sparks intern to study how the region was actually doing with this plan. They found the goals may have been too aggressive on the time period set.
The original date was that by 2022, which was the date that the last RTP was adopted, that 80% or 8 out of 10 housing units developed in the county would be quote-unquote walkable or bikeable. So as part of post-adoption of the 2022 RTP, we actually got an AmeriCorps Civic Spark intern to spend some time with us and do a deep dive on what we call our baseline statistics for these targets, which we collectively call the Safe and Sustainable Transportation Targets. And what that particular person found was that I believe only somewhere along the lines of 40 or 50% of the housing units built in that baseline year 2022 met the criteria.
To make housing walkable and bikeable would require new infrastructure and zoning regulations.
Realistically, if local agencies are going to meet those goals by placing housing in spots that are fully walkable and bikeable by that particular definition that's in the RTP, it's going to require the continued development of infrastructure. So the bikeability goals are measured based on bike lanes and other means for where somebody can, you know, bike from the location of the housing downtown area.
For walkability, the bar is also hard to achieve. Walkability is judged if a housing unit is within 10 minutes walking distance to downtown. Byrd explained that pushing these timelines is not HCOG abandoning these important goals. It is acknowledging and adjusting the amount of work and time needed to make these changes.
We could keep the target as it is today. What we've demonstrated is even with infill development patterns, we can't meet those targets without more infrastructure investments or more zoning and land use modifications. So bringing the timeline forward on that is a recognition that it is a process that we intend to move to, but It's also a recognition of the fact that we can't necessarily readily do it right out of the box today.
During the interview last week, Fisk also brought up the elimination in the new plan that called for a funding consistency analysis, a check to make sure that HCOG is going forward with projects that align with the RTP goals. Byrd explained that HCOG is proposing to replace the policy with a different one that incentivizes cities and counties to seek outside grants because of limited local funding.
This year alone, in this two-year cycle, we at HCOG were only able to award $3 million in transportation funding for all of our member agencies. So that's all of 7 cities within the county and the county itself. And unfortunately, $3 million is not a lot of money. It sounds like a lot of money to a singular person, but in terms of a transportation project, $3 million is only about 1/5 the construction cost of the Humboldt Bay Trail project that just happened. So the one that went from Eureka to Breakut there. So what we are proposing to do in that particular policy is to, again, bring in something that would incentivize local agencies to try and seek or leverage local funding in order to get those grant dollars, because realistically, those grant dollars are what bring transformational level funding to our local transportation system, because our existing funding sources just aren't sufficient to do anything but kind of in some ways maintain the status quo and make very incremental improvements.
The draft regional transportation plan is currently out for public review, which means anyone can read the plan and reach out for needed improvements. HCOG is expected to complete the final version, including changes to environmental language and targets, in February of next year. On December 20th at 1 p.m. at the Shelter Cove RID and Fire Station, 12 Southern Humboldt Fire Departments will sign a joint powers agreement, creating the first Fire and Rescue Joint Powers Association for the region. Nat Cardos reports.
On December 20th, 12 Southern Humboldt Fire Departments come together under a joint powers agreement to establish the Southern Humboldt Fire and Rescue Joint Powers Alliance. This historic move isn't a consolidation of the fire departments, but will improve regional cooperation through the sharing of resources and administrative responsibilities. KMUD News spoke with Camilo Stevenson, Public Information Officer for Bryceland Fire, for more about how this JPA will work.
This is not a consolidation, and it's not taking away from the identity or the independence of any of the local volunteer fire departments. What it does is it will be improving regional coordination. It'll be sharing resources, collective expertise, and working with, you know, finances so that every department can be helping each other. You know, we have a lot of small departments. Some are larger than others. And we've already had years of, you know, working together. You've been covering our regional wildfire readiness trainings in Southern Humboldt. You've seen pictures of, you know, 150 plus firefighters coming together to do the trainings there at the Southern Humboldt Community Park. And this is basically building on that experience to incorporate a structure for all of us to work together more cohesively.
The concept of this alliance has been in the works for approximately 25 to 30 years, and efforts were originally spearheaded by the late Bryceland Fire Chief Tim Olson. The goal of this JPA is streamlining training amongst fire departments, as well as to improve the efficiency of administrative paperwork. KMUD News spoke to Nick Pape, Fire Chief for the Shelter Cove Fire Department and President of the Southern Humboldt Fire Chiefs Association, for more information.
Yeah, so this is actually kind of a brainchild of the late Chief Tim Olson. 25 years ago, they were talking about all the small districts in Southern Humboldt and how they'd be more powerful together. And the original idea of a consolidation and one big fire district kind of fell apart, and took almost 20 years for the conversation to start back up due to a needs assessment that the Fire Chiefs Association did. And basically, that was just a survey of, hey, you know, all the chiefs have similar needs, similar problems, and what are some of the solutions that we can find? And one of the biggest and best options that we found was the Joint Powers Alliance. And so through a joint powers agreement with all the departments that are members, we're going to build a new agency that will help support all the admin needs, the grants, the training, and all the stuff that a lot of our volunteer fire chiefs just don't have the time to take care of. So a lot of folks don't really know, but volunteer fire departments still have all the same legal obligations as big, large career departments. So we still have to meet a lot of the same training standards, a lot of the same financial audits, and it's a big burden on the fire chiefs. So one of the first things that this new JPA wants to do is take as much of that burden off the fire chiefs as we can. And with that will hopefully come some career opportunities for paid admin staff that can actually have a real job sitting down and taking care of a lot of these admin burdens for up to 13 member departments that are currently signing up for it.
Southern Humboldt has approximately 244 volunteer firefighters, and in 2024, collectively responded to over 1,400 emergency calls. Because the number of firefighters is so low and the areas they serve are so large, resources tend to be stretched for training and apparatus maintenance.
They're a very large geographical area, and we're talking from Petrolia, Myers Flat, all the way to Palo Verde and Shelter Cove. You know, Southern Humboldt is a huge geographic area and very challenging terrain, obviously, the Lost Coast. And so with the volunteer departments, we're talking about really challenging conditions to maintain, you know, readiness to respond to these emergencies in the backwoods and in this challenging area.
So one of the biggest things it's going to do is it's going to help with the redundancy of all these different districts having to do the same exact paperwork. So if we can knock out a lot of that paperwork through one single agency or the JPA, again, we can take a lot of that financial and time burden off of these districts. Also, the narrative there, instead of individual departments, the 13 individual departments are relatively small on the scale of some of these grants that we're applying for. The narrative, when you put all of Southern Humboldt together, becomes a much larger narrative. So, for example, just south of Weot, there's almost 300 firefighters that we're already training and providing workers' comp for. You know, 70 fire apparatus, so 70 different fire engines and trucks and almost 30 stations. So it's actually a large fire family that we're dealing with. And so how can we best support that so nobody gets left behind? And right now we have fire departments and fire districts that are on the verge of not being able to respond. And due to people having to get jobs or turnover or people that are getting hired by other local agencies, we want to maintain that level of care and service for all the communities in Southern Humboldt. And this was the best chance that we had of doing that.
On December 20th, the signing ceremony will be held at Shelter Cove RID and Fire Station that is open to the public and begins at 1 p.m. Representatives from all 12 founding departments will be in attendance, as well as community leaders and partners.
So on the 20th, everything's kind of coming to fruition. So we're going to have the public's invited, and we're going to have all the members. So we have 13 different fire agencies that are going to provide a signer. So it's either going to be a commissioner, a district board member, a fire chief. And we're going to celebrate this event and the future of the fire service in Southern Humboldt. It is truly a historic event. Something like this, as I said, has been being talked about from 25 to 30 years. And the last 3 years have really been putting a lot of work into making this a reality. And Saturday, it's going to actually be signed, and from then we're going to create a board, and you know, here hopefully in a couple months the Southern Humboldt Fire Rescue Joint Powers Alliance will be a real thing and start helping districts in our area.
More information on the event can be found by calling Shelter Cove Fire Station at 707-986-7447.
Southern Humboldt Fire and Rescue, their vision is to create a unified and resilient fire rescue and emergency medical services that enhances community safety, fosters collaboration, and ensures the highest level of emergency response for all communities in Southern Humboldt. Through shared resources, collective expertise, fiscal responsibility, and a commitment to excellence, we aim to protect lives, property, and the natural environment, building a safer, stronger future in our region.
This is Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD News.
A new approved Humboldt County plan sets measures for reducing the greenhouse gas emission impact of new development, transportation, and other activities, Daniel Mintz reports.
After debate and compromise on setting an overall greenhouse gas emissions threshold, Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors approved a new regulatory framework for controlling local contribution to climate change. Approved at the board's December 16th meeting, the Regional Climate Action Plan covers the entire county and maps a path to carbon neutrality. It targets various transportation and development activities for reducing emissions and has 12 strategies for doing it. They include the cornerstone measure of creating a regional climate coalition, decarbonization of construction, and a variety of measures to reduce vehicle use and encourage use of electric vehicles. The overall goal is to keep the county's emissions below a threshold geared to the state's goal of carbon neutrality by 2045. The plan was described as being long overdue during a public comment period, but Southern Humboldt resident Thomas Mulder, who is a county planning commissioner, questioned the plan's rural area measures.
As I sit in front of my fire, I came here just for a moment to sit in front of my wood-burning stove that I greatly appreciate, that I legally changed out under alternative owner builder, which I cut down the trees, and my son and my father, myself and my father-in-law and my nephew milled those trees up for the lumber to build my house. Also the other wood buildings around. I don't want someone to lose that right and that ability. So please be mindful when you're talking about rural living, not to take those rights away from someone. I would hate for my son to be able, not be able to have a wood burning stove if for some reason this house burnt down and we had to rebuild it and you have this new rule. Oh, can't have a wood burning stove. New rules.
Asked later about Mulder's concerns, Planning Director John Ford said wood-burning stoves will still be allowed under the plan, but their use will be limited to EPA-approved devices. As with the Planning Commission, much of the supervisors' discussion focused on the plan's most sweeping measure, setting a total greenhouse gas emission threshold. Measured in metric tons per resident, the threshold provides a basis for evaluating whether development projects will have significant impacts. An original threshold was reevaluated by Rincon Consultants Incorporated, which concluded it was too permissive. Rincon's recommendation is to reduce it by 50%. But Supervisor Michelle Bushnell vouched for a lesser reduction of 25%. The action plan's overarching framework and the broad responsibility for addressing climate change were discussed in this exchange between Ford and Bushnell.
If you were to, for whatever reason today, decide that, you know, we don't want to do this, we're going to deny it. Mm-hmm. So then what happens is that when future growth comes in, mm-hmm. or projects come in, they have to do a CEQA analysis. Mm-hmm. And they have to evaluate the greenhouse gas mm-hmm. Emissions. Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, part of what the discussion is here is that if we can establish the RCAP and people can come in and be in compliance with the RCAP, that's one less threshold they have to cross.
Mm-hmm. And so through the discussion, I've heard that the increased cost for some industry or building or development could be increased $5,000 to $10,000. And that's the anticipation that you would see.
So I don't know if it's an increase, because right now if somebody, I mean, there could be things they need to do to address climate change okay. needs. But those are things that we all really need to take accountability for.
Right, I understand that.
And so it's not targeting any one organization, individual, industry.
Okay.
It's really about rethinking what we need to do to address climate change.
Supervisors debated the threshold level and agreed on a compromise to reduce the threshold by 35%. Commenting on the concerns over restrictions, Board Chair Mike Wilson said not addressing climate change will exact the highest costs of all.
We imagine sometimes that climate change is static, that if we do nothing, everything stays the same, but it's not. It's dynamic. It's moving forward. It's becoming worse, and we need to adjust for that. And everything we do will have cost to it. Every new technology, every energy source we pursue, whether it's renewable or anything else, will have an impact and have a cost to it. There's no energy source that has no impact, and we have to be really clear about that. Not just impact to our environment in its direct construct, but also in terms of our economics and everything else. And sometimes there are positive impacts to all those things, and we know what those are. And sometimes there are cost savings associated with energy costs and those sorts of things. So I just want to say that that's important. We have to remember we're like in a truck or something heading towards a cliff, which is the climate change, and there are, we're trying to turn the wheel and we can't get concerned about spilling the coffee.
Supervisors unanimously voted to approve the Regional Climate Action Plan with the 35% threshold reduction. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Arctic continues to warm faster than other parts of the world and is experiencing record high temperatures and record low levels of sea ice. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which released its annual report card for the region Tuesday. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Niden reports those findings directly affect Alaska indigenous communities.
The Arctic report card has been documenting changes in snow and sea ice cover, as well as air and ocean temperatures in the northern part of the globe for the past 20 years. It has shown that in that time, the Arctic's annual temperature has increased at more than double the global rate of temperature changes. Hannah Marie Ladd is the director of Indigenous Sentinels Network.
These changes cascade directly into people's lives, affecting fisheries, coastal safety, and subsistence harvests. We are no longer just documenting warming. We are witnessing an entire marine ecosystem, which is tied to our economies and culture, transform within a single generation.
The report highlights an emergent phenomenon called rusting rivers. That's when permafrost thaw causes groundwater to seep deeper and interact with mineral deposits, which likely turns some streams and rivers to a rusty orange color. Abigail Pruitt says that in Alaska, over 200 streams turned orange in recent years.
Within Kobuk Valley National Park, we observed the complete loss of juvenile Dolly Varden and Slimy Sculpin in a tributary to the Akilik River when it turned orange. Beyond the effects on fish, rusting rivers may impact drinking water supplies to rural communities as well.
The report highlights how Indigenous communities have been observing the changes in the environment and wildlife and collaborating with scientists to better understand those changes. Ladd, with the Indigenous Sentinels Network, describes one example of such work. St. Paul residents collect samples of harvested traditional foods, like seabirds, marine mammals, and halibut. Those samples are tested in a tribally owned lab and analyzed for contaminants like mercury.
Indigenous leadership, local workforce development, and community-driven observing are not optional. They are essential to understanding the Arctic that we have today and preparing for the Arctic we are moving into.
In response to a question about how federal cuts to climate science might affect the future of the Arctic report card, NOAA officials said that they will continue their efforts to observe the change in environment. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Niden.
Two tribal communities in New Mexico will be receiving state grants for high-speed internet development. KUNM's Jeanette Didios has more.
Santa Clara Pueblo and the Fort Sill Apache Tribe will each receive a planning grant of $100,000 through the New Mexico Grant Writing, Engineering, and Planning Program. In a release, the state's Broadband Policy and Programs Bureau Chief, Andrew Wilder, said the funding will help start important projects in tribal regions that lack high-speed internet. Santa Clara will use its grant to build fiber lines connecting homes and provide Wi-Fi service. Fort Sill plans to create a high-speed broadband network connecting unserved homes. The tribe has already secured $500,000 in infrastructure funding for fiber, equipment, and trenching. The state's Office of Broadband has already issued 36 awards totaling $3.5 million to 17 tribal communities, 15 local governments, and 4 rural electric and telephone businesses. The broadband office stated that $1.5 million are still available in planning grants. The awards are assistance-based, not merit-based, so entities do not compete for funding. No matching funds are required.
For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineers, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Matt Cardos, Daniel Mintz, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, a national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.